Just one thing, just one bit of interest is that we, this last week, we had two significant events. One was the fastest accessioned document in the history of the National Archives, which was the agreement on the Scottish referendum, which was signed and delivered here in the same day and accessioned the following morning. That's something of a record. As you can imagine, there's stuff out there still waiting to be accessioned that arrived here some time ago. So why this document was particularly lucky. It was on display until recently with the cheapest looking pen. You know the ones you get at a conference? It was like one of those, you know, any minute the spring was going to pop off in with this very undramatic document. The other thing is we also received our first full-scale digital ingest. So there's been lots of talk over the years about the paper-free office, and we've been involved in most of it. We've been talking about digitised records for 10, 15 years in this organisation, and I know others in the room have been doing the same. For the first time ever, we received born digital records in a significant size from the Olympic Operating Authority. In fact, all of the LOCOG records, all in one, because the organisation ceased to be pretty rapidly after the end of the Olympics. DCMS, as you know, aren't a particularly large organisation, and so we stepped into the breach. It seemed like morally the right thing to do before somebody told us to do it, and we've taken that digital record in one fairly substantial lump. Now, it's the first of many. We're planning to take Home Guard records from the MOD at some point, which is a massive set of documents from World War II, very, very widely heralded as a really rich source of information. And one of the things we discovered in that was that what we've all come to believe about the Home Guard is largely based on the BBC TV comedy series Dad's Army. Unfortunately, when they actually reviewed the Borough of Cumbria as a trial before the digitisation process, it was realised actually it was Lad's Army rather than Dad's Army. So rather than a platoon full of Godfreys and Pikes, it was, rather a platoon of Godfreys and Mr. Jones the butcher, it was actually platoons full of Pikes, you know, 50, 16, 17-year-olds. And that's a problem for us, because that means a large number of those people are still alive, which means the number of closed records becomes extremely difficult in terms of redaction. And for a commercial partner to commercialise that, to digitise that lump of material in a commercial way, it meant life was getting extremely difficult. So the LOCOG stuff's important for us because it gives us a big lump of material that we can work on, and more of that as we go ahead. So that's the afternoon. That's okay with everyone. If that's okay, David, we'll just launch straight into the intro if you like. So, and then I promise you I'll shut up for the rest of the afternoon, apart from telling you things are what we're going to do next. All right. I'm just going to whiz through an intro, really, to the organisation, particularly for that before we go for a wander around this afternoon and we see how the place is set up. So the National Archives, for the record, for good, that's our strap line. It's been our strap line for about 3 or 4 years. It's good because it brings back the information management profession into the archive profession within the organisation, and that was felt to be important by our chief executive as we moved forward. I'm going to just run through our buildings and locations, a little bit about repositories, a bit about the display and your certificate, and then how the department is structured. So we are a government department. Unlike most of you who are formerly a cultural organisation, we're a government department and we're executive agency of the Ministry of Justice. Now, that strikes some people as slightly odd in terms of grouping, but we're actually, one of our primary statutory responsibilities is publishing a legislation. So all statutory instruments, all amendments are published, formally published by the National Archives and laid by us before Parliament. So without the National Archives Legislation Services Department, no law would make it onto the statute books. It's an administrative function and it's part of the old HMSO setup. And as a result, we've always had close links and been governed by the Lord Chancellor, the Justice Secretary, and that's why we're in the MOJ. It has a number of advantages and it has a number of disadvantages. So we're closer to the centre of the universe and we're lucky in the fact that we're directly funded by Treasury. So our funding doesn't come from MOJ, but we're structured within the MOJ family, okay? We're the official archive of the UK government, so we hold government records. Historically, some other stuff's come through the door, but these days we're pretty strict. We're pretty strict about what we take. So it's essentially government records. So we're part of the machinery of democracy in the fact that the Public Record Act requires that the public has free access to the machinery of government. Okay, and that's why that is set up in that way. We act as the guardian of government's information, and we're the information managers for government. So we advise the registries, we advise the record managers about what to keep, what to chuck out. We preserve about 10 million public records. It's up to about 11 million the last time I looked at the presentation, but dating back over 1,000 years. So we've got the Doomsday Book, we've got a copy of the Magna Carta, and we've also got some really, really interesting stuff on sheep. And there's such a lot of stuff on sheep. I looked the other day, somebody's saying that the amount of records we have on sheep in the early 16th century is bizarre. And we're the experts in information creation, care and use. So, 1838 Public Records Office was formed, was on the back of the Public Records Act, and that was in Chancery Lane. Those who ever went to the building before we vacated it, a fine building in central London. 1977, Fort Mortlake, as it was known by the locals, was built next door. In the days when Crown exemption existed for planning, as you can sort of tell, can't you? This site had been owned by Crown since about 1918, and all the mapping for D-Day was carried out here by the US Army. It was an Italian prisoner of war camp, so it had various uses, and there's a Cadillac factory next door building Cadillac aircraft engines under license. It got bombed quite heavily. And so they built that on it. So some would say it wasn't an improvement, but there we go. It's evidently extremely important piece of late 20th century industrial architecture. That's according to the planning officer, sadly, at Richmond. So I'm sort of holding my breath that he doesn't decide to list it. In 1996, the second Q building was built, which is the one we're sitting in at the moment. And in 2001, the name of the organisation changed to the National Archives as we brought in the Office of Public Sector Information and Her Majesty's Stationery Office. So since then, we've been known as the National Archives. So the estate. The main estate is mainly centred here at Kew, as you know. This is really where the organisation lives and operates out of. The site itself is about 4.8 hectares. There's a lump in the corner of demolished building. There's actually private land. It's been sold off to a developer, but due to the collapse of the property market, it's sort of between owners at the moment. So we sort of look after it because it's inside the wire, and we gain 60 to 70 car parking spaces off the back of it. So I'm in no hurry for them to develop the site. We're in about 65,000 square metres of net internal area, and at the moment we're operating on about 570 full-time equivalent staff, although the target is about 550. So we're not a massive organisation by any means. We also have six staff in Dragonfly House in Norwich, which is a DEFRA building, so we've got a small office there, and that's a legacy of the fact that the HMSO's main office was in Norwich. And their commercial entity, they were commercialised, privatised back in the early 90s, is still there. So they publish all our legislation via contract, and so it's useful to have some people on the ground in Norwich. Length of that tenure is probably about 2020, and then we'll be gone, I expect. It's the greenest office building in East Anglia, and it has a BREEAM Excellent certificate, which means, as you can imagine, it's cold in the winter and hot in the summer. But they're still working on that. We also have some hot desks in our main department, if you like, in Ministry of Justice. We used to have an office of about 35, but you can imagine how much that cost in the middle of Whitehall. So we moved those staff back at the beginning of last financial year here to Kew, and we keep 10 hot desks on the sixth floor, mainly for directors and other managers having meetings in central London with Cabinet Office in particular and at MOJ. Not the cheapest desks in the world, it's fair to say, from my perspective, so I'm reducing from 10 to 7 next year. Finally, we have some storage, some leased storage in Cheshire. This is at the Winsford Salt Mine, the largest producer of road salt in the UK by a significant margin, part of United Salt, which is a US-based company. What they discovered over the years is you can see this cavern is a worked out salt cavern on the right. They leave these large columns of salt in to support the roof. Once they've worked them out, they can't take them any further for safety reasons, so they head off in a different direction. So there's about 25-30 miles of underground tunnels. Half the mine is live, half the mine is dormant. So they constructed some buildings within these spaces and set themselves up as a record management company. We were their first customer, and I think we were probably quite helpful in getting them going in the first place. It's, in a scheme of things, is extremely cheap storage per linear square, per linear metre of shelving. It's very stable, it's very dry, it takes a little bit of humidification and quite a lot of dust protection because it's quite a dusty environment. But actually, from a carbon footprint, it's very, very low carbon storage. We put, there's about 30 kilometres of storage in there. We grow by about a kilometre a year. It's, as you can imagine, the low use material, because putting it in there is cheap, getting it back out again is very expensive, because they've only got one lift, and okay, you can get a cement mixer in that lift, but they tend to be using it quite a bit, so getting stuff out is quite expensive. We do have an unfettered access agreement, being public records. We need to, if somebody needs to go down there and answer an FOI question, for instance, they can go in there any time of day or night. They just have to dress up like a miner to do it and to have various medical checks. We've got a pool of people who can do the unfettered access should they need to. So fascinating visit, and if anybody really feels like going, it can certainly be arranged. So space utilisation. The reason this slide is on here is because we're not part of the office, the admin estate. We're part of the mandated government estate, but we're not part of the office estate. And I think everybody out there in front of me probably fits into that category as well. And that's useful because we're classed as an operational building because of our public access, which means although we pay lip service to the SD targets wherever possible, where they get a little bit too difficult, like the water target, for instance, for offices, we tend to stay away from that one. But we're classed as an operational building. And in this context, estates is front office, which is nice, makes a nice change, because normally we're parked in finance and corporate resources or something like that. Here we're in the operational directorate because we're delivering a number of services, both to the public and to the record. We'll have some public reading rooms, and I will definitely, those that come around on the tour, will have a walk through the public reading rooms. We're set up really we've got three reading rooms. Two are closed and one is open. The decision was made in 2008 when we refurbished the building that we'd have an open access reading room. So any member of the public can walk through the door, up the stairs, speak to a member of staff, log on to a PC. They're not allowed to take their coat in or a bag. That's the only proviso. But basically they can log on and use our online resources and start their research. So most people begin their research journey in the open reading room, and only when they feel the need or the requirement to view an original record do they go upstairs and register as a reader. That's relatively simple, pretty much the same as the BL. Photo ID, proof of address, and they're in. You know, they don't actually need to declare what they're doing. That's their right to come into the building. And then we have a map and large document reading room on the second floor and a document reading room on the first floor, which are behind security barriers and are subject to invigilation. So security officers just make sure people are abiding by the rules, so not underlining stuff and leaning on documents. And we'll touch on that as we have a wander around. So that's really changed the mix for us, because we have a lot of people that come into the reading room, a lot of genealogists. Genealogy is huge, especially thanks to Who Do You Think You Are on BBC. That's really probably half of our reader base, visitor base is about genealogy. Saturdays, coach loads of genealogy clubs come all over the UK to do their research here. And the majority of that can be done in the open reading room. And it's only the really, real professional genealogists or real clever amateurs that really deep dive into the records. And there's quite a rich source of that here. Our other researchers tend to break down into a number of professional research groups, but particularly military historians, people writing military books. There's tons of military records. You know, the MOD are very, very good record retainers, and we've got some good stuff, as they say. Repositories. So we've got about 150 kilometres of storage, and as I said, about 11 million documents, and that's over half of our footprint here in Kew. Both buildings, over half of their floor plate is in storage. And we'll have a wander through those. And as the slide says, we're on seasonally adjusted environmental conditions, which Costas will touch on in his presentation. This is my department and how we are set up. As you can see, I report to the Director of Operations and Services. I've got a small in-house team, intelligent client team of 9 staff. And then at the moment, I have a 3 contract base. I have a hard FM, essentially an enhanced hard FM contract, a cleaning contract, and a dining concession for catering. And we run the normal gamut of stuff, including the health and safety advisors embedded in the estates department, because we're considered to be the highest risk. I think that's probably true. And we introduce more risk than anybody else. But we also look after things like car parks, you know, and those that do, you know, fellow sufferers out there. That's real good fun, isn't it? So recent major projects that we've completed, you're lucky really to come 2 weeks after the scaffolding came down, because we looked a bit of a mess, it's fair to say. We have been replacing all of this vertical glazing here in the Q2 building, which was, I suspect, pretty badly installed as well as not maintained. So when I arrived, we had 30 or 40 roof leaks and yellow buckets outside the chief exec's office, which, when you're the National Archives, even though it was nowhere near the repositories, and the repositories are double-skinned profile sheeting with slates over the top, it just don't look good when the minister comes and there's a man with a yellow bucket catching drips outside. And, you know, I didn't even drill the hole above the chief exec's office to get the money. It really didn't exist. So that's been about a year and a half. We also added on the vertical glazing in the entrance hall you came in, which was also leaking pretty badly. So it's about a £2.5 million project by the time we'd finished delivering that. Thank God it doesn't leak anymore, because that was my worry. Incidentally, as I said to somebody earlier on, that's not my house there. I live in the social housing block about three or four down, so I'm about 3 minutes walk from work, which on the whole is a good thing, but just down again is a bad thing, as you can imagine. So that's some of the scaffolding from the inside. I have to say, staff astounded me when we set off on this project. We didn't move anybody. Well, we moved 10 desks that were directly under one of the roof lights, but we didn't move anybody. We just made them get on with it. And it's amazing how adaptable staff will be when you communicate. The project team did communicate particularly well, you know, across all the disciplines with internal comms. And that was the key, really. And it's amazing what people will put up with. What is interesting is how quickly they revert the moment the project is finished. So now we're back to the toilet roll doesn't work and I can't dry my hands on the hand towels, and aren't those hand dryers noisy? So you know you've had a successful project when it's finished, when you sort of revert. Boilers. We have a new boilers fitted into the old building, and those who want to come on the tour will walk past those. Combined heat and power, as the other side of those three boilers, is the base load now, which was part of that project. Three new turbo core chillers, which a few people in the room have either got or have been to see. I think they've proved particularly successful in reducing our energy consumption and improving environmental conditions in the repositories. So a double win really for us. We've just finished a humidification upgrade in the older building, and we're in progress just about to finish the humidification upgrade in this building, which pretty much completes the holy trinity on the air conditioning side of life. Those who have been in the toilets, we did a massive toilet program of all the toilets across the site in about 3 years, not only to go to a more maintainable toilet, but also water saving, energy saving, but as much as we could pack in, okay? You know, there's been some blips along the way, it's fair to say, when you do all those sort of things at once. Take the user with you, is my advice, see how I would say. And the culmination of that really for us, and I know some people have seen this slide before, but I had a bet with my environmental manager. We were here last year. I had a bet with my environmental manager that he couldn't get us to see. And of course, I've managed to keep the money, obviously, because he got us to be. So, you know, I said, you know, devil's in the detail of the small print, Maxwell. So he's a bit fed up with me because he thinks I owe him 20 quid somehow. I don't know. That obviously is pretty phenomenal performance. And I was asked once at a Sustainable Development Board meeting at MOJ. I think it was during the Prime Minister's 10% reduction in 1 year programme. How big my carbon reduction budget was. And I said, I don't have a carbon reduction budget. And everybody around the table looked at me, oh, you know, we're going to get into so much trouble. And I said, everything we do, we consider carbon. So every project we do, we say, can we spend a little bit more on the chillers, for instance? We go for a light flight replacement, or should we spend a little bit more on turbo core chillers, on the best technology we can afford, and then reap the benefits from it? And fortunately, I have a very, very receptive executive team and management board. And they've supported me in spending, of the 14, 15 million we've spent, we've probably ploughed 3 or 4 million of that specifically into projects that either had a direct carbon benefit or had some additional carbon benefits. And so we've saved, last count, about £1.7 million on gas and electricity, mainly on electricity, to be honest. Now, on the flip side, the organisation declared itself as a 1 megawatt organisation back in the 90s, when it was like kudos to be a big power user. And it never really was, I don't think. It was an energy pig. So this, the big stuff's been easy. The next 3 or 4 years is going to be a lot more difficult because we've done the big stuff. Now we're going to get into the territory of telling people to turn stuff off, or perish the thought, get IT to turn stuff off at night like they're supposed to. So there's lots of work still to be done. Do I think we'll ever get out of B? I think we stand a reasonable chance, to be honest. I think we stand a reasonable chance. It doesn't happen. Doesn't help that we're suffering from hot and cold complaints at this time of the year because of the transition from cooling to heating season. So no heating system's perfect, but this is bad timing. When you whack this on the wall, people say, oh yeah, well, it's always cold in my office. No wonder you save so much electricity. So that's an issue for us in terms of comms.